Set of 12 German dances by Ludwig van Beethoven. I wonder if he attended the masked ball that he wrote the pieces for. And I wonder what his mask looked like. Anyway, that was Kurt Masur leading the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. I'm Gillian Martin. Thanks for listening.
This is WHFR Dearborn, and you're listening to WHFR out of Henry Ford Community College. We thank you for choosing WHFR as your classical connection. If you would like to learn more about what's happening in and around WHFR, programming changes, where we might be doing appearances, and so on and so forth, then we'd love you to be a part of our WHFR Loyal Listener mailing list. It is a free opportunity for you to receive right to your doorstep the WHFR Loyal Listener. It is our bi-monthly newsletter that shares all of the latest happenings of WHFR, both out and about in town or programming changes, music reviews, and so much more. And best of all, it's free. Simply give us a call, 313-845-9842. Leave your name, full address, and phone number, and I will put you on the WHFR mailing list just like that.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn, non-commercial radio from Henry Ford Community College.
Good morning. This is WHFR Dearborn, and you're listening to the show called Medically Speaking. I'm your host, Mike Holloway. And as the name of the show implies, we will be speaking about things metaphysical during the next hour. And my special in-studio guest today is Mr. Robert Thibodeau. He is the owner and operator of the Mayflower Bookshop. He's also a spiritual astrologer, psychic reader, speaker, spiritual researcher, and musician, singer, songwriter. A very busy guy. And with all that being said, I would just like to say, good morning, Robert. Thank you for being on the show. How are you today?
I'm doing good. How do you?
I'm real. The first thing I would like to know is, I know you're really well known around the Detroit area as far as metaphysics is concerned. Do you consider yourself a metaphysical icon at this point in this area?
Somebody, there was a class at U of M called me and they said they wanted to interview me as part of a program that was, you know, some kind of icon, and that the lady wanted how many followers I had.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, do you?
She's going to imply that or something. So I said, like, talk another 5 minutes after. I said, when you talk like that, you think I have followers? And she said, oh, no. I said, no, you know. So I don't think I'm an icon as much as A.P. McCarthy in the old days on another WJR radio, big state around the United States. He said something like, you know, how do people say, I know you predicted things that go with political things in the weather and sports. To my amazement, how do people see you? Do you think of yourself weird? And it's kind of a silly question. And I thought, you know, gosh, you know, met John Lennon, convinced me to be vegetarian. Later, really? I found out that you could feed 8 times more people. I'm a vegetarian, organic, I play electric instruments, plug in, some guys play electro. deliver a baby home. You know, I thought I was normal, everybody else was.
Right. Just I look at it, right?
It's all relative. You know, to me, I'm the earth. I'm a guy who thinks that the day that the corporations or the governments or the leaders loving the earth, all religions, if they're loving the earth as a primary, that God is in everything living. The Christos of the ancients, the Christ, Krishna of Hindu, it weaves and breathes through all that light, Celts thought, you know, is in the light that reflects in the earth and the light of our dreams. But I think I think the world's becoming numb, and some people have become artists, and other people sunk deep into, you know, matter a little too far. And I'm kind of a guy who thinks that you can think with your heart.
Mm-hmm.
That heart is capable of informing who's telling the truth and who's lying, who's a real person. And there are no reptilians, there are no no aliens here among us. Everybody's a human, and some people are buried, and other people are disembodied while in front of us, almost half dead. Shakespeare said, you die before you die. A lot of people are kind of disembodied already. So, the answer directly, I think I'm just a human being, and I think being a human being, that every day I have to rediscover who I am.
Mm-hmm. Is that hard to do?
Now, you have an emptiness practice, the Dalai Lama is. Not if you can say, like, the Christian not, but the within me. Not if you are a person who loves trying to understand, listen to the songbirds in the morning.
Mm-hmm. You say you respect all living things?
I love respect and a great student attitude about learning, life and learning, all living things. In the Bibles, they say, love all God's creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm for, you know, the wars we have. They give you the report, like, today, 50s died, 25 squirrels got accidentally killed, off. You know, they don't give you the stats, animals. And humans are obviously primary importance. Our younger brothers and sisters, trees, birds, and plants, and the earth itself is living through water. In American Indians, all these names for water. Water was much more alive. A water, you could live on it, you know, strongly for a day, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And now the water is dead and is dying, you know. Water, air, and food quality is leaving as the spirit of the world is shrinking. So, you know, I'm a guy who thinks that each being is composed of spirit and mind, soul, psyche, and body. And our spirit is touched with everything that happens on earth. One of us is affected by everything bad that happens on earth. And each one of us has a body that can separate us off from everything so we can be alone with ourselves or individualize, think for ourselves.
Mm.
Freedom from the unified field theory. Freedom from God. Freedom from ourselves being stupid or ignorant. We can look with ourselves and discover out of freedom a loving, kind relationship world around us.
Mm-hmm. So you feel that you refer to the fat trees and, I guess, things of nature are our brothers and sisters. So thing is related, whether it's human or animal or mineral or whatever it might be.
Right. There's obviously a hierarchy in a way, and there's a differentiation of harmonies that you can't have all the musical instruments in an orchestra collide. They have to find their place. So, yeah, I think everything's important. I think everything's important, that there's some kind of divinity underneath everything. Like, divination isn't just me. It's not about fortune telling. It's fun to predict Super Bowl or a presidential election or the mayoral election. It's fun. But what's much more fun is to divine the divine in another person.
Mm-hmm.
Lovers do it. Musicians do it. I'm not sure if the weatherman and the stockbroker do it. Maybe sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah, I'm sure. Once in a while, anyway. Now, how did you get your start in metaphysics?
I think I was brought up very Christian. I believe that Jesus was a friend of mine, you know, and that God was a friend of mine. And I had kind of an intimate connection with a feeling that there were angels.
Due to technical difficulties, we will no longer be able to bring this broadcast of Metaphysically Speaking. And instead, we're going to bring you a broadcast previously heard of We Are Not Alone.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone, where local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. And for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomena. The modern UFO era officially began in the summer of 1947 with Kenneth Arnold's sighting in Washington State's Mount Rainier, and the alleged crash of a flying disc near Roswell, New Mexico. However, there is much evidence to suggest that advanced civilizations from elsewhere in the universe have been visiting Earth since ancient times. One of the most notable proponents of the ancient astronaut theory is Giorgio Tsoukalos, who has often been described as the real-life Indiana Jones. And Giorgio is the publisher and editor-in-chief of the legendary Times periodical, and works closely with Chariots of the Gods author Eric Von Däniken. He's been featured on numerous documentaries on the subject, on the History Channels, as well as many others. And we're pleased to have him on the show today. Hello, Giorgio.
Hey, David. Thank you very much for this marvelous introduction. I'm very honored to be here.
Wow, we're very honored to have you here. You've been getting quite a bit of press lately as to the ancient astronaut theory, and been on documentaries. What was the last one you were on, the latest?
The last one I was on was called a series on the Travel Channel called Mysterious Journeys, and the last show was called The Nazca Lines, and that was one of three shows that I was on the Travel Channel, also in this whole Mysterious Journeys series, and two of the other ones were Alien Hotspots and Easter Island, and by far out of the three, the Nazca Lines episode was the best one, because they did something that a lot of other documentaries didn't do. they delved into mysteries for which there are absolutely no explanations.
When you say no explanation, does that leave open the possible explanation of ancient astronauts?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And because, for example, at NASA, I'm a proponent or a representative of the classic ancient astronaut theory, which essentially proposes that Earth has been visited by extraterrestrials in the remote past. And by remote past, I really do mean remote, as in 5, 6, 7, 10,000 years ago. And at NASA, we've always, by the critics, been accused that the ancient astronaut theory proposes that NASA was an airport for ETs or a spaceport. Hmm. And granted, seen from the air, NASA looks like an airport, but it never was. Hmm. So the mysteries of NASA essentially, and that's the thing that the Travel Channel portrayed very beautifully, aren't necessarily the figures that all the other shows dwell upon all the time. All they care about is, to show these geoglyphs and the ground markings of some animal figures, and that gets really boring, and those can be recreated without a problem. However, at NASA, you have, humongous mountains which have been essentially just flattened. So you have entire mountaintops that have been sheared off as if by some sort of a knife, and you would think that for that, not only do you need technology, but let's say the entire mountain was quarried off piece by piece, don't you think that somewhere we would have the rubble of that quarried off mountaintop? Mm-hmm. Well, nowhere in that area can you find that rubble. So it's very mysterious and a huge, huge undertaking.
And you don't think that these sheared off plains on the mountains could have been naturally formed?
No, because they are too perfect. Hmm. And, and they're, luckily, they are right in the middle of other mountains and mountaintops. Hmm. And so the examples that we have, they completely stand out from the norm. And therefore, you can conclude that that is not a natural occurrence, especially because in those parts where the mountain summit would converge, it goes over, grooves and cliffs and gorges, you can see exactly where the entire mountain was quarried off or flattened. Hmm. I mean, it's very, very interesting.
So there's evidence that it was man-made, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Not
naturally formed. And here's another thing, that the classic ancient astronaut theory also does not propose that these mountaintops were quarried off or were created by aliens. The classic ancient astronaut theory does not say that. We also do not say that, for example, the pyramids were built by aliens. Mm-hmm. What the ancient astronaut theory does propose is that all the ancient monuments were, in fact, created by human hands, but, as the ancient texts and ancient traditions say, with the assistance of extraterrestrials. And therein lies a big difference, mm-hmm. because there, right there, you all of a sudden have a very plausible explanation how our ancestors, who literally just came out of the caves, all of a sudden built the pyramids, or they built Stonehenge, or, very monumental structures with no apparent technological evolution.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us a little bit about Stonehenge. We've all seen the pictures of Stonehenge. Some of us have been there, but they say, that was just an ancient calendar. What do you say to that?
Yeah, well, it makes me a little bit laugh because, granted, no question Stonehenge does have some elements in there that do refer to a calendar.
Mm-hmm.
However, let's remind ourselves that our ancestors from a long, long time ago, they were way more in tune with nature than we are today.
Right.
So if you build a calendar, you know, to tell you, you know, when spring starts or when winter starts or the fall and so on and so forth, you know, it's all very questionable because, like I said, our ancestors are very much in tune with nature. So let's say this monument, the Stonehenge, told the people, okay, on this day, you know, spring has begun, and now it's time for you to put the seed in the ground for a great fall harvest.
Hmm.
Well, what if on that day or during that period it's still very cold out and the ground is frozen?
Mm-hmm.
Our ancestors knew exactly when to put the seed in the ground for a great fall harvest. They did not need to build such a monumental structure just to tell them when to plant stuff. You know, a simple wooden stick in the ground would have been sufficient.
All right. That's
and
right.
So an interesting thing about Stonehenge is that if a lot of our listeners, like you said before, have seen pictures. Now, if you look at Stonehenge from a bird's eye perspective and you look right down on it,
mm-hmm.
you have a whole bunch of concentric circles that make Stonehenge. Now, a mathematician in the astronomer/mathematician in the 70s, he actually looked at this and he said, you know, this looks all very familiar. And he looked at our solar system and he determined mathematically that every circle, every concentric circle that we have at Stonehenge corresponds with one of our planets in the solar system, including Pluto. Now that's spectacular stuff.
That's before. Are we talking about before Pluto was discovered?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And the thing is that Pluto was just demoted as a planet.
Yeah.
But regardless, Pluto was discovered in 1932,
right.
And Stonehenge predates the pyramids.
Right. But I guess what I'm saying is, the scientist figure this out to include Pluto after we knew Pluto was there? Or, well, obviously Stonehenge, if you're going by that theory.
Well, the mathematician performed or conducted this research and published his findings,
mm-hmm.
I believe, in the late 60s, early 70s.
Okay.
So that was 40 years after, or 30 years after Pluto's official discovery.
Right, but Stonehenge was still there for eons, right?
Oh, Stonehenge predates the pyramids in Egypt. I mean, we're talking 8,000 years ago.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then the pyramids and the Sphinx. Now, it was after the Sphinx was discovered that they discovered that there were feet underneath the sand there that they didn't even know were there. Am I correct?
Yes.
Those had passageways and... And what have you? What did they discover of those feet?
Well, I mean, there is multiple stories and speculations out there that right underneath or in between the paws of the Sphinx is an entrance, a gateway to an underground tunnel system that exists underneath the Giza Plateau in Egypt.
Hmm.
Now, the tunnel system most certainly exists. Now, will mainstream Egyptologists agree to that and say yes? Of course not. But we've seen pictures. There has been drawings of people that have been there. There are schematics, and most certainly a very, very intricate tunnel system does exist underneath the Giza Plateau. Now, I'm sure a lot of people have also heard of the Hall of Records.
Mm-hmm.
Allegedly, there is this repository of knowledge that is somewhere in or around the Giza Plateau. And, you know, if anyone reads the ancient accounts of the Egyptian histories, then many, many references are made towards such a place that contains the knowledge of the universe or the knowledge of our time. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting to see that all this knowledge or all these references towards that particular idea are conveniently brushed under the carpet by mainstream archaeologists and the mainstream Egyptologists.
Well, if there's all of this evidence just to show that these passageways are there and what have you, how can they, and it's kind of like the UFO phenomenon itself. You got all this documentation and evidence and photographic evidence and people's testimony, and you lay it right out in front of the authorities, and they just continue to deny. Am I giving a good parallel here?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Of course, absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, that's how it is. But see, here's the crazy thing. Well, it's not necessarily crazy. This is just a simple fact of life, that there are essentially two kinds of people on the planet. One group tries to explain everything away with you know, in a religious way, like with God or with the spirit or something like this. And then you have another group of people who try to explain everything with cold hard science. But regardless whether or not these people look at a mystery from a religious point of view or a scientific point of view, in the end, both camps of people will agree at the very end, saying, but regardless of anything, we are the greatest. We are the pinnacle of creation, and nothing else but us exists in the universe. Mm-hmm. There can't be anything bigger or better than us. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the idea that we might have been visited by extraterrestrials in the remote past, or that we are being visited by ETs right now, is beyond the grasp of, unfortunately, the majority of mankind, because it does not fit into the current paradigm. It unfortunately does not.
It's beyond the ego of mankind. Is that what you're trying to say here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That, you know, I mean,
we'd have to come down a peg or two, wouldn't we?
Yes, we would, because all of a sudden, you know, where are you from? Oh, we're just, you know, we're no longer from Europe or from America or whatever. We're from planet Earth.
Uh-huh. My goodness. And there's another race out there of beings that are more intelligent than we are, more advanced than we are. How frightening. You'd have to change our whole paradigm, wouldn't we?
Well, I would venture to say that, personally, in my opinion, I don't think it should. It is a frightening thought. I think it's a very comforting thought that we're not alone.
Oh,
and
it is.
All these, there's so many, in the whole UFO field or in this whole field in general, there are so many doomsayers out there that say, oh my gosh, if the extraterrestrials show up, they'll just come here to kill us or to eat us or to harvest us for food or whatever else. And all I have to say to that is baloney, because if that really is the case, it would have happened a long, long time ago, and we wouldn't be here today. So, I mean, don't get me wrong, good and evil permeates the entire galaxy, permeates the entire universe, but I really think that, you know, it is in everyone's best interest that eventually we will make contact. And when that contact happens, it'll most certainly, in my opinion, be something along the lines of what we've seen in Star Trek, that it's a sort of benevolent thing. But until then, you know, I don't think much will happen in terms of official contact, because making contact with that quote-unquote, as it sometimes is referred to, intergalactic club isn't necessarily a right. It's a privilege. And right now, our planet is not doing that great. The way we're going with wars and exploitation and everything else. So, I mean, the way I like to look at it is the reason why the extraterrestrials have not yet made official contact with us in the 21st century is because have you, David, ever tried to get in contact with a heap of chickens? I haven't. And right now we're the chickens.
And we have not earned this privilege, have we?
No, not right now. I mean, 10 years ago it looked good. Right now, 2007, I'm an optimist by nature, but right now, I don't know.
It's 2008 now. This is aired in January.
Hmm?
This is aired in January 2008, so it's 2008 now.
Oh, okay, so
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to everyone.
We're going to have to take a brief non-commercial break right now, but we're going to get back with Giorgio Tsoukalos of the Legendary Times. And I need to remind everyone that you are listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we will be right back with Giorgio Tsoukalos, and so don't go away.
Presenting comments you won't ever hear at your house.
Hey, Dad, you need a hand with that yard work?
You know, honey, the heck with the playoffs on TV. Let's go shoe shopping.
Never mind our anniversary, dear. Go out with your friends and have a good time tonight.
Almost as rare, it's unlikely you'll ever hear someone say, you know, it's time for an eye exam. That's because many vision problems have no early warning signs. In fact, 1 in 3 Americans over 40 has a vision problem, and they might not even know it. An eye exam can spot vision-threatening conditions like glaucoma before you can, and even spot serious health problems like diabetes and high blood pressure. So if you're over 40, remember, an eye doctor can see things you can't. For more on vision health, visit checkyearly.com. That's checkyearly.com. A public service message from the Vision Council of America and AARP.
French fries again? Pass the asparagus, please.
Do you find it difficult to find the time to work out? Does the price of a gym membership seem too expensive? Don't let these reasons get in the way of exercising. Try the Henry Ford Community College Fitness Center. The HFCC Fitness Center is conveniently located on campus in the Athletic Memorial Building. Drop in between classes or before you go home for the day. You'll save valuable time because you won't have to commute to a gym. And the best part is that use of the fitness center is free to HFCC students. Students should bring their student ID for access. Lockers are available for no charge, but you must provide your own lock. Come and work out at the HFCC Fitness Center.
Listen, was that you always on? If and when that's true, waiting stops within.
Do you like your jazz soft, hard, free, swinging, or maybe a combination of these? If so, the Play It By Ear show is sure to satisfy your taste, regardless of style. Tune in every Tuesday in Drive Time, 5 to 7 p.m. with me, Terrence Tyson, the Jazz Master Slayer, only on WHFR.FM 89.3, the station making waves.
This is WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and I'm David Twitchell. We're speaking with Giorgio Tsoukalos of the Legendary Times. Giorgio, tell us a little bit about the periodical and the organization, Legendary Times.
Well, David, Legendary Times is the official journal of the Center for Ancient Astronaut Research. And Legendary Times essentially is the definitive ancient astronaut journal. And every 4 or 5 months, we publish an issue, and we just came out with a very with our very latest issue. And this one that I've got right here in front of me, it's 80 pages thick. It's got over 20 articles in there, and it's all very, very exciting. We report about the latest research findings in the ancient astronaut field. For example, in this issue, we talk about Angkor Wat in Cambodia, where I'm sure many of our listeners have seen those magnificent temples of Angkor Wat that have been built with very, very high precision. And if anyone looks at the stories or the mythologies behind Angkor Wat, they are filled with these strange legends of these beings that a long, long time ago descended from the sky and taught mankind in various disciplines. And we also talk about this particular issue has a world-exclusive article in there written by Eric von Daniken about the latest research findings at NASCA. And now that the issue is out, I'm actually allowed to talk about this. And basically, you know, mainstream archaeology says that there are no mysteries at NASCA, but there really are. And one of them I mentioned before was the flattened mountaintops. But another mystery is that at the beginning and at the end of some of these lines or these white bands that look like airstrips, they were not airstrips, they just look like them from the air. You can put down a compass and it'll just keep turning while it'll just keep spinning and it won't stop. And in some locations, you will also find high, high levels of arsenic. And that's another thing that is very mysterious, because arsenic, you know, to have such great spikes of arsenic in certain areas is very uncommon. And so all that stuff currently goes on at NASCA with you know, advanced research and things like this.
Well, what do you think the arsenic levels would indicate, or is this that just one of the mysteries?
Well, I mean, of course, yes, it is a mystery, but the possible explanation behind this is that some extraneous chemical reactions took place that were artificial. That is the reason, and especially at the beginning and the end of these airstrips that, or these lines that look like airstrips, you know, that something, it's as if, you know, magnetic lines are converging, and the Nazca culture knew exactly where those points of convergence are.
Like the ley lines that we talked about.
Ley lines, yeah. Exactly. And another article that we put in there is talking about gold planes that were found in ancient Colombia. I mean, the
gold airplanes.
There are these little gold artifacts that were found, and they were found by the hundreds. Little gold artifacts that were, you know, little amulets or brooches or you know, pins or something like this. And you know, a lot of them did in fact represent animals, like, you know, fish, and there are insects and you know, lizards and a whole bunch of weird animals. However, out of the hundreds that were found, there are about a dozen of these gold artifacts that do not look like fish or bees or mosquitoes, but they in fact look like modern airplanes. and it's uncanny. I mean, you don't even need to have any type of fantasy to recognize a flying machine or an aircraft in some of these artifacts. Mm-hmm. You do need fantasy in order to say this airplane is a bee.
But when you look at this artifact, and it looks like an airplane, didn't the craft that were reported back in ancient times and biblical times have these discs, same disc shape or cylinder shape, cigar shape that we talk about today? Didn't they have that shape back then as well?
As well. See, there's multiple reports.
Right.
Especially the ones that are, you know, in the Old Testament of the Bible. Mm-hmm. You know, you have the descriptions of a cylinder shape, or for example, in old paintings. Mm-hmm. But for example, in the Old Testament of the Bible, Joseph Blumrich, he is a fellow that unfortunately died a few years ago, but in the 60s and 70s, he was one of the chief engineers of the Saturn V rocket that blasted off to the moon. Mm-hmm. And he later worked on Skylab, so he was your proverbial rocket scientist. Mm-hmm. And when Eric von Däniken was at his prime, when his book came out, you know, Chariots of the Gods and all his following works, mm-hmm. Eric von Däniken was invited to Huntsville, Alabama, to NASA to give a lecture. And in the audience was this guy, Joseph Blumrich, and he was one of the biggest skeptics you could ever imagine. And he was, like I said, a rocket scientist. So there is Eric on stage giving his lecture, and he tells the audience how, you know, in the Bible, in the Old Testament, in the book of Ezekiel, what we have described, the glory of the Lord, is in fact a spaceship. And after the lecture, Joseph Blumrich walked up to Eric and he said, "You're crazy." And you know what? On top of that, I am going to completely disprove you. So Joseph, that night, went home, took out a Bible, and started to reread Ezekiel. Mm-hmm. And then what started was the biggest conversion of one of the biggest skeptics to one of the biggest supporters of the ancient astronaut theory. In fact, Blumrich said, "Not only is Eric von Däniken right, but I am going to recreate, on paper, of course, this spaceship that Ezekiel allegedly saw in the sky." Wow. And then later that Ezekiel flew around in. And so Blumrich came out later in 1976, came out with a book called The Spaceships of Ezekiel. And there we have a rendering or a proposal, a technical drawings by Blumrich with what looks like a inverted cone-shaped spaceship. Mm-hmm. And that is just in the Bible. Now, we also have multiple descriptions of flying machines in the ancient holy texts of India. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, if you read their sacred texts such as the Mahabharata or the Ramayana or the Rig Veda, all those different holy books, they are, I mean, if you read that, it's as if you're reading, you know, Star Wars.
Right, right.
And there, the flying machines of the gods are called Vimanas. And even today, in the Hindi language, Viman still means airplane. Mm. By the way, you know, when I say gods, please, it's always lowercase g, mm-hmm. and they had nothing to do with anything spiritual or anything divine or anything magical. Those were flesh and blood space travelers who visited Earth, and our ancestors who weren't dumb, but their frame of reference was too limited. They couldn't explain the nuts and bolts aspect behind their technology. But so they, that's why they were mistaken for gods.
But with a common denominator, be it in ancient astronaut theory back in ancient days or in the biblical days or during the biblical writings, is that these gods or God or slash angels or whatever it was, whether mythical or biblical, they all came down from the sky. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely, David, and I'm so glad you're bringing up that point, because in our field, you know, there are some people now, or well, not now, but for some time now, that said, oh, you know, it has nothing to do with extraterrestrials. In fact, it's just a past super civilization that essentially just got eradicated, and you know, but they were not, those visitors or those beings were not extraterrestrial in nature, but they just came from a different continent.
Mm-hmm.
But here's one thing that these people neglect to tell you, and that is whenever, regardless on what location on our planet, regardless of what culture, when the natives or our ancestors, the human beings, asked these visitors, where do you come from? The visitors never pointed across the ocean or across the mountain and said, we come from over there, or we come from across this big water here. Mm-hmm. But they always, always, always pointed to the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And most of ancient literature, there's a predominant preoccupation with the heavens, or the sky, or what they call the cold emptiness of darkness.
Right.
And that is just another description or allegory for space.
Well, now, if they came from another continent across the ocean, why would they talk about the darkness unless their continent was completely dark, you know?
Thank you very much.
Doesn't make much sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you are right.
These are certain.
You know, and see, the ancient astronaut theory is so wonderful in that, you know, we're looking at old stuff, old accounts, ancient accounts,
mm-hmm.
with a modern space age perspective.
Right, right.
And that's all we're doing. And then if you do that, all of a sudden these ancient texts make incredible sense, and it no longer has to do with symbology or interpretation where, oh, they just talked about, you know, some gods or some gods and all this, and yes, they built this monument for to worship this and that god. See, that this is what archaeologists or mainstream archaeologists always do when they're asked, well, what was it for? Then the number one answer is for the gods, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's the explanation. But what legendary times, what we do here at the Center of Ancient Astronaut Research is, well, what gods? See, the question or the answer doesn't stop if you concede, oh, it has to do with the gods. Then the production only begins, because mm-hmm. you have to ask, well, what gods?
Mm-hmm.
Because I can tell you this, you know, to attribute everything to, you know, human fantasy and inventing of stories, I think that's an insult in the face of our ancestors.
It is. It is. Even the Native Americans, their quote-unquote gods, lowercase g, came from the sky.
Yes, absolutely.
It's a common denominator.
We have an incredible array of deities, you know, like Quetzalcoatl, Cucumatz, Kukulkan, all those gods. I mean, for example, Quetzalcoatl and Kukulkan were, by the way, one and the same deity. Translated into English, that name means feathered serpent. Now, we all know a feathered serpent does not exist, but whatever our ancestors saw could best be described with a feathered serpent. For example, if you and sometimes Quetzalcoatl or Kukulcan was also described as a silver-headed snake that, you know, floated about in the sky. Now, if you on a nice summer day, you go outside and you watch the sky and you see a plane fly above you, what does it look like? It has a silver, you know, tip or a silver head, and the trail that it leaves behind from the exhaust, that's the
serpent
body.
Uh-huh.
So right there, you know, and obviously, they didn't have the vocabulary. Like I said before, and I cannot stress this enough, because our critics always throw this in our face, which isn't even true. Our ancestors were not dumb. They were highly intelligent beings, but their frame of reference just wasn't there to describe or understand technical things.
Right. We're going to have to take another break right now, but we're going to get back with Giorgio Tsoukalos. And you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves. I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone, and we are exploring the ancient astronaut theory with Giorgio Tsoukalos of Legendary Times. And right after this non-commercial break, we are going to go back to him and wrap it up. So stick around. Seizure disorders affect more than 100,000 people in Michigan, 30,000 of which are children. The Epilepsy Foundation of Michigan exists to ensure these individuals and their families receive the resources and support necessary to live normal and productive lives. As the only statewide nonprofit organization that focuses entirely on seizure disorders, the Epilepsy Foundation of Michigan enhances lives and changes communities by making it easier for people with epilepsy to live in society. Whether through its programs such as Camp Discovery, Living Well with Epilepsy, or Epilepsy Entertainment Gatherings, the Epilepsy Foundation of Michigan sets out each day to act as ambassadors for those coping with this condition. For more information regarding these and other programs, volunteer opportunities, or how to donate, feel free to visit the Foundation's website at www.epilepsymichigan.org. The Epilepsy Foundation of Michigan. Not another moment lost to seizures.
Criminal justice studies are concerned with the preservation of peace, the prevention of crime, and the protection of life and property. A knowledge of the role of criminal justice in our society also serves to emphasize the importance of balancing the needs of society to maintain social order against the need to safeguard individual rights. For more information on the HFCC Associate Degree Program in Criminal Justice, contact the Criminal Justice Department at one of the following numbers: 313-845-6437, 313-845-9714, or 313-845-9859.
Radio fans, Imagination Works has been revamped. Are you familiar with radio drama? If not, become acquainted with old-time radio mysteries on WHFR, late night Monday, 11 p.m. until midnight. Hear The Mysterious Traveler, The Inner Sanctum, Suspense, and much more. Hear classic radio drama on Monday nights, 11 p.m. until midnight, on the station making waves, 89.3.
This is the station making waves, WHFR.FM, and I'm David Twitchell on We Are Not Alone. We're speaking with Giorgio Tsoukalos of Legendary Times, and Giorgio, you often cite what is termed cargo cults as parallels to ancient astronauts. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Absolutely, and that is such a fascinating topic because a cargo cult essentially is an anthropological term, and it essentially means that a cargo cult comes into existence when you have a technologically primitive society meeting up with a technologically advanced society. The main example that we have with a cargo cult is in the 1940s during the Second World War, when the U.S. Started to establish bases in the South Pacific. They essentially arrived there with their big ships and their planes, and they were on some islands, like, for example, the island of Vevac. And, you know, the American soldiers arrived, and they were friendly with the natives, with the inhabitants of those islands. And, of course, at first, the island inhabitants were terrified. What they were seeing in front of their very eyes. They were befuddled. Oh my gosh, what are these big gigantic floating things, and what are these birds, that the planes that they couldn't explain what they were. And interestingly enough, later you know, and of course after the Second World War ended, all these bases were disbanded and the American soldiers went back home along with their equipment. Now, 5 years later, some anthropologists went back to those very same islands to check up on those inhabitants, and they encountered the most bizarre things. And that is, the islanders had recreated airplanes made out of straw and wood, and every night they recreate a ritual where they essentially played those planes taking off and landing, and they all had rifles that they were carrying on their shoulders made out of wood, and they were speaking into little wooden boxes mimicking a walkie-talkie and all those things. And that phenomenon has entered anthropology as what's called the a cargo cult, and this one in particular was called the John Frum cult because, you know, all the American soldiers introduced themselves to the natives, and, you know, one of the biggest names is most popular names is John, and when we introduce ourselves, we always say, "Hi, I'm John from Nebraska, I'm John from California," whatever, whatever, so all the natives heard was John Frum, John Frum, John Frum. So John Frum is now a main, or the main god in the South Pacific. And the reason why it's called cargo is because obviously the Americans also gave the natives chewing gum and t-shirts and cookies and whatever else have you, so they gave them cargo. So after the Americans left, the natives start to worship or create this religion, this cult, because there's nothing more than they wished for than for these, you know, quote unquote gods to come back. And so our argument is that if something like this could have happened in the 20th century, why couldn't this have happened here on Earth?
Right.
Well, 2,000 years ago, and our conclusion is it did happen.
Yeah, not only in our century, but when the Spanish arrived in the Mayan community in Mexico.
Well,
pretty
that
much
was
the same
the,
thing
the,
happened.
That is the main reason why the Mayans and the Incas were literally conquered. I mean, that was a huge. Empires that were conquered by literally under 200 conquistadors. And the reason why that happened is because the arrival of the conquistadors happened to coincide with the same year that, according to the Mayan, to the Inca mythologies, Kukulkan or Quetzalcoatl announced his return.
Oh.
And so they thought that the Spanish murderers are the deity, or were the deity, but they weren't.
Mm.
And so that was one of the main reasons why they essentially all kneeled down in front of the Spanish conquistadors.
Also, the return of their quote-unquote gods happened in Hawaii when Captain Cook arrived.
Absolutely.
And they thought he was a guy. They happened to be out on the natives happened to be out on the shore waving these big white sheets. Obviously, the ship had come in, the sailboat had come in years before, and they were worshiping the god, waiting for the gods to come back by flailing these sheets around. And here comes Captain Cook and his merry men, and they worshipped him as a god, right?
Yes, and the interesting thing is that, you know, all these things happen, you know, according to the calendars, they all happen every 52 years, mm-hmm. which means back then the life expectancy of people was much shorter than that, so nobody was really around to tell them, well, this... Those are the wrong gods.
That's not the ones you thought.
Yes.
Yeah. So what role, if any, do you believe these ancient astronauts had in our physical as well as our technological development?
Well, technological most certainly huge impact because the ancient texts speak, and it doesn't matter which ancient text you look at. You can go to any culture in the world, and the original texts all say the same thing, mm-hmm. that a long, long time ago, these the heavens or the sky opened, and these teachers from the sky or the guardians of heaven or whatever you want to call them descended from the sky, by the way, always in these strange metallic-looking silver eggs out of which a ladder was dropped, and you know, out of which these beings emerged. By the way, they were all very humanoid looking. They weren't the proverbial you know, Hollywood stereotype of an ET with four heads and tentacled arms and stuff like this. So, and they arrived, or when they came here, they taught mankind in various disciplines, such as architecture, engineering, mathematics, astronomy. And all those different things. Now, as for whether or not they had any impact on our physical appearance, I have to say yes, because, you know, we always ask ourselves, well, what do these extraterrestrials look like? Do they look like us? And I think we should turn that question around, and that is, could it be, and in my opinion, I'm convinced of that, could it be that they don't look like us, but we look like them?
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the basic definitions or tenets of the ancient astronaut theory is that, you know, that one little thing that nobody talks about is Darwin's missing link. Mm-hmm. Because anyone who has read the Origin of Species will say or knows that Darwin, in the very end, concluded, well, this theory is great, it makes a lot of sense, but it only makes sense if this missing link can be filled in. And he conceded, he said, I don't know what the missing link is. I don't know. And to make a long story short, that's what